This hour, we hear from Jeff Madrick, author of Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World, published in 2014. Jeff Madrick is editor of Challenge Magazine and director of policy research at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy and Analysis at the New School in New York City. He's also the author of The Age of Greed, published in 2011. Madrick says that economists didn't merely not anticipate the economic crash in 2008 and 2009, but actually helped it to occur because their ideas led to bad strategies. Jeff Madrick spoke on October 23, 2015, at the Madison Central Library in Madison, Wisconsin. His talk was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival.
I am delighted to be here. What I'm most delighted about is I'm able to talk about perhaps my favorite subject, why you should not trust economists. Probably most of you have a good idea or don't trust economists already, but let me try and put maybe not some meat, but at least some fat on that bone. You all know by now economists did not anticipate the great crash of 2007-2008. Nor did they really anticipate the slowness of the recovery thereafter. Usually, when you get a sharp downturn in an economy, which means GDP or national income falls sharply, it rises rapidly in response. Didn't happen this time. Well, economists didn't know that the GDP was going to crash like that. They certainly didn't know the markets were going to crash the way they did. And why should they? Their theories, their ideas said it couldn't happen. Let me say that again. Their ideas said it couldn't happen, which is what provoked me to write this book, Seven Bad Ideas. We'll go over a couple of those ideas. Because those ideas said it couldn't happen, those ideas in turn, in fact, led to the market crash and led to the poor economy and, in fact, near-depression economy of 2008 and 2009. So economists didn't merely not anticipate the crash. Far worse, they helped it to occur. They helped it to occur because their ideas led to bad strategies. In fact, the argument I would like to make, and I don't want to get too simplistic about it, but I would argue on balance, economics is a political ideology. It is not a science. It has some scientific aspects. Maybe there are a few economists in the room who would take umbrage at that. There are some techniques. There are some interesting quantitative techniques that keep getting more sophisticated. A lot of empirical work is based on economic thought, which I think can be quite valuable. And I think, in fact, empirical work is what's most valuable about economics. But by and large, I would argue it's an ideology. And that's why it doesn't work. Why did we have this ideology from the 1980s through to the crash? Well, I'll explore that a little bit and what's to follow. But let me put some fat on the bone. Robert Lucas, a Nobel Prize winner in 2003, said, economists have learned how to avoid recession or depression. Said that point blank. Major Nobel economist. Olivier Blanchard, a left-of-center economist. Lucas, as you know, is quite right-wing and a former student of Milton Friedman. Olivier Blanchard said in 2008, after the economy was falling rapidly, macroeconomics, which is the study of how to measure the aggregate economy, the big economy, he said point blank, 2008, macroeconomics, the study of the economy, is in good shape. And he's a left-of-center guy. And a highly regarded MIT economist, now at the IMF. I think he's retired. Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, a smart guy, a Princeton economist, said for years the economy was not too hot and not too cold. In other words, as in the Goldilocks mythology, not too hot and not too cold. And in that kind of environment, the economy could grow as efficiently and rapidly as possible. Milton Friedman in 2005 told the eminent Charlie Rose. I always laugh a little bit about Charlie Rose, but anyway, that's just a personal thing. Don't let that get out of this room. Milton Friedman said to Charlie, why is everybody worried about the economy, 2005? It's stable. It's as good as it's ever been. Already, the subprime mortgages were starting to collapse when he said that. Now, why did Milton Friedman say that? Because he believed the economy, as long as the government kept its fat hands off of the economy, these kinds of things couldn't happen. And increasingly, partly and maybe even largely due to Milton Friedman, the government was keeping its hands off the financial markets, off of setting wages. In other words, wasn't setting a minimum wage, wasn't trying to tell companies how to set their wages, wasn't enabling labor unions to get any bigger, was indeed enabling them to be reduced from business pressure. The center of all this is my first bad idea. It's the economic idea you all learned in first year economics, the invisible hand. It's an idea we love, don't we? I loved it. I talk in the book about how I loved it. It solved many mysteries for me. Of course, I was 18 at the time. I didn't know how many mysteries there really were. But the invisible hand says when prices go up, there'll be less demand for a product and more supply. When prices go down, more demand, less supply. The supply and demand will meet in the middle at an equilibrium point. But here's what it also says, and that solves the problem. Is the main point. That solves the problem of keeping government out of the market, because the market will do it all on its own. It will reach this ideal state all by itself. It can only get fouled up if the market tries to control prices, sets tariffs, sets controls on capital flows. That's the only thing that can really foul it up, according to the beauty of the invisible hand. More than that, however, the invisible hand led to maximization of prosperity. Now, that's a tough one. That's a tough one to explain or even to understand. It implies that everybody gets what he or she wants. In the maximum aggregate economy, it implies, and that's another kind of theorem, that you can't change a price or a quantity supplied or made without making anybody else worse off. Wow. Now, does anybody remember the word utopia? Remember all those lunatic utopians from the 1800s, all of whom had very long beards, like some of you have, who are preaching different kinds of utopia? Usually it had something to do with government control of markets. Here was the free market economists' utopia. They didn't dare call it utopia because that would sound a little bit irrational. But that's what they implied. They said it was utopia. The problem with the invisible hand, of course, is big companies can control prices. They're so big. They're monopolies. They can control the wage they're going to pay. Unions, if they're big enough, and there aren't many of these left, can in turn control the wages they get paid. They can make these markets inefficient. Another issue is in financial markets. Why would the invisible hand work in financial markets? When the price goes up, there should be less demand, right? That's how the invisible hand works. But in a financial market, when the price goes up, probably people want to buy more of the damn thing. When the price of Apple goes up, people are saying, whoa, what did I miss out on? Let me get into that. When it falls, people will say, we missed the boat, let's get out of it. That's how financial markets work, often, not always, but often. Often enough to distrust the invisible hand in financial markets. Now, the invisible hand goes farther than this. The invisible hand suggests that the correction of any displacement in the market, any eruption of nasty little things that may lead to recession, they automatically adjust. When the price goes down for something in a recession, there'll be more supply, there'll be more demand. That, in turn, will encourage people to make more and will straighten the economy out. Now, the second bad idea I propose in this book is Say's Law. A French economist, you've heard of him, J.B. Say, actually, later than Adam Smith. And he proposed that all you have to do, I'm simplifying a little bit, but not too much to distort the argument, all you have to do is save in an economy, and the economy will be okay. That's because interest rates will fall as people put their money in the bank or buy bonds. And when interest rates will fall, companies will make investments. And investment is the key to future economic growth. Now, that's true. The last part is true. Investment is the key to future economic growth. But is that the way you get the most investment? That depends on a notion about the invisible hand, right? When there's more supply of savings, the interest rate will go down. The invisible hand works when the interest rate goes down. Of course, business will invest. It makes sense to all of us, right? How could it be wrong? Problem is, it usually doesn't work that way. Not always, but usually doesn't work that way. And that was John Maynard Keynes' big argument. In the 1930s, many people were arguing, most of them Republicans, that the way to get the economy to work again was to save more. How do you save more in a national economy? If the government spends less, then the government may have a surplus, or at least they'll reduce the budget deficit. If you reduce the budget deficit, you raise national savings. Keynes said, holy cow, that's not right. And he thought about this pretty hard. And he thought about it, I would argue, very well. And he said, the problem with this, he didn't quite say it was the invisible hand, but he said, the problem with this is Say's Law is actually bunk. What propels investment is not necessarily a reduction in interest rates, not necessarily a rise in savings, but an increase in income and therefore demand for goods and services. What propels investment is a demand for goods and services. Now, a lot of people know this, right? Because Keynes wrote his major classic book in 1936. In the 1950s and 1960s, most major economics departments were Keynesian. In fact, Larry Summers was Keynesian for a while. Then he became Smithian for a while. Now he's returned to become Keynesian for a while. And he's still the most prominently cited economist around, which tells you why, in a nutshell, why you shouldn't trust economists. You also shouldn't trust the media who write about economists. But that's maybe we'll get into a little more detail about the remarkable Larry Summers. In any case, what Keynes was really saying is, hey, the invisible hand doesn't really work in this instance. What will happen is if people save more, if the economy saves more, maybe interest rates will go down in time, but more likely demand for goods and services will go down because they don't have enough money. They're not spending. What we need is demand for goods and services to go up. So he proposed an entirely contrary idea. The federal government should spend more. And that way we'll increase demand for goods and services and business will invest. And guess what? It worked. It worked throughout the mid-50s. It worked through much of the 1960s. It worked throughout the 1960s. And it worked until the early 1970s. But what can also happen is you pump too much government spending. Too big a deficit. So let me step back for a moment. Federal deficit, budget deficits can be good. They're often good. But you can't have too much of them, and that leads to inflation. Too much demand for the amount of goods that can be produced. That's when it gets dangerous. Got a little dangerous in the early 1970s. Now, I don't quite believe all this, But I believe all of the Keynesian stuff. I believe there was a lack of demand in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Government spending compensated for that lack of demand. You know what was also great in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which people rarely talk about, wasn't great for most of us who believe that the Pentagon has all the money it should ever get. But defense spending was very high in the 50s and 60s. Top of my head, I can't quite remember, but I think it was 10 and 12% of GDP, far higher than it is now, the various wars in the Middle East. So that was government spending. That pumped up the economy, and we didn't even know it. We thought we were doing it for defense purposes.
You're listening to Jeff Madrick speaking on Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. He spoke at the Wisconsin Book Festival on October 23, 2015.
The interstate highway system. We all love it now, don't we? I remember I was a boy in Long Island, and the highways were going through. As a little boy in the 50s and 60s, and we had our little skateboards for the first time. They were really dinky little skateboards, and we'd go down the on and off ramps before they were built, and you'd run into the dirt and the gravel and all that kind of stuff. I was not as bold as some of my friends. But anyway, how was the interstate highway system sold? As a defense project, national security. But it worked to pump the government, to keep the prosperity going. It worked in the Keynesian way. Now, we've kind of forgot about that in the 70s and 80s under the influence of Milton Friedman, who said government always created inflation and inflation is always bad. Government spending created inflation and inflation is always bad. Well, we had a monumental amount of inflation in the 1970s. Friedman said it was due to this government spending. Most of you, well, a fair amount of you probably remember the 70s. I'm looking at this young woman here. She's the only one in the room who doesn't remember. But the inflation rate, I appreciate your coming. The inflation rate went crazy in the 70s. Was it due to simple Friedmanite government spending? Hardly, or at least only a small part was. A lot had to do with explosion in commodities prices. A lot had to do with the oil price, OPEC's oil price embargoes. The oil price went up first by three times and then twice. All in all, it went up by five or six times in that decade. So it was a mix of things. Whatever it was, inflation went high. Friedman got a lot of kudos for that. And many left-wing economists thought he was right. Many left-to-center economists thought, this guy's dead right, what should we do? Well, what we should do is push interest rates up to keep the money supply from growing, and we'll control inflation. That kind of led us to what I call the third bad idea. The third bad idea is low inflation is always good. It was a Friedmanite idea brought into power by Ben Bernanke and a bunch of economists around the world, in New Zealand, in Canada, in Germany, always afraid of inflation. And what the argument was is that all government policy should be involved with is keeping the inflation rate low. Now, this is an invisible hand, automatic efficiency argument, but they don't tell you that. They just say inflation is bad, by and large. Inflation is bad, let's get rid of it, and the economy will be fine. What they're basically saying is the economy automatically adjusts as long as we get inflation from perverting it. So once we do away with inflation, the economy will be very efficient, economic growth will rise very rapidly, and everything will be almost perfect. Now, that's an invisible hand argument. It argues the economy adjusts because prices go down and this goes up and da 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 da, and just keep government out of it. And that's what we did. Did you know that? From the 1980s through to the mid-2000s? We kept government out of it, basically, except for monetary policy. under the great general and admiral Alan Greenspan, who totally believed this, keep inflation low. I don't think he quite got it in the subtle way Bernanke gets it. But keep inflation low because it gets in the way of a markets operating to the benefit of all of us. Automatic. It's automatic. It was called inflation targeting. And Ben Bernanke said we were living through, from roughly the early 80s to the mid-2000s, something called the Great Moderation. It meant more stability, less instability. And that meant markets worked more efficiently. Did it mean you would think they would measure the growth of GDP to see how it did in periods when the market was more stable? They didn't really bother with that. This was a proclamation from on high, hardly argued against by serious economists. The Great Moderation. What happened during the Great Moderation when Bernanke thought the economy was almost perfect? You couldn't get it any better. Not too hot and not too cold. What happened in that period? Inequality? Stagnation of male wages? Slow growth even of female wages, though they grew? That's the perfect economy? A rapid rise in inequality. What is he talking about? In that same period, there was one financial crisis after another. There was the 1982 Mexican crisis. There was the 1987 East Asian crisis. There was the, and Wall Street, long-term capital management. Thank you. Long-term capital management crashed. Had to be saved. Russian and Turkish debt almost crashed. What happened was Greenspan, in cahoots with Rubin and Summers and so forth, and Bill Clinton, came to the rescue every time. Well, you could come to the rescue. It worked until the time it wouldn't work. It didn't really work in 2000 and 2008 to avoid cataclysm. It did work to avoid Big Depression. So inflation targeting, in my view, failed, and I think economists are beginning to recognize that. Let me talk about one other bad idea, or two other bad ideas. One is the idea that there is no such thing as a financial bubble. Now, do any of you remember when people like Greenspan used to suggest that? He could say there'd be a little bubble, but we could never recognize it beforehand. People like Bernanke said the same thing when he was in office. Can't be a speculative bubble. Not a very dangerous one anyway. What were they thinking about? Well, early on, goes back to Milton Friedman, early on, people would argue, well, if the price of a stock or a bond was really out of hand, a smart person, because the markets are so fluid, stock markets, there's so many people in them, so many smart people are in them. They would sell the overvalued security, and that would drive the price down. So maybe you have a slight bubble, a slight run, but you can't have a really big one. Now, I'm not kidding you. Read Milton Friedman's 1953, 1954 articles on this. He was talking about currencies. It's hard to believe, but that's by and large what people argued, that you couldn't have a big speculative bubble because there were smart enough people to sell when prices were high and buy when they were low. Some University of Chicago economists did fancier work on this, and I hope you'll read this chapter, because some economists who criticized the book thought people should read, because I go through the history of the development of this way of thinking. For a while, it made some sense, but then it got crazy. And it led to the deregulation of the late 1990s and early 2000s, led indeed by Larry Summers and Bill Clinton. They didn't want to regulate derivatives. Worse, derivatives were these risky instruments that many believe were the heart of the financial crisis. Worse yet, they didn't even, here's the killer, okay? This is the killer. This shows the hypocrisy of many of these people. Derivatives were not an open market. The stock market's pretty open. You see where prices are. You see who's buying and selling. The bond market's pretty open. Even the junk bond market, pretty open. But the derivatives market wasn't open at all. You couldn't see who was buying, you couldn't see who was selling, and you didn't even know if the people who were borrowing a lot of money to buy a certain derivative, invest in a certain position, could pay it back. AIG, for example, you couldn't even tell. Now, one of the main features of the invisible hand, and I think I did not mention it, is that information about these products has to be open for the invisible hand to work. Otherwise, how can people make an intelligent decision about buying and selling? There was no information on the darn derivatives. So I'm arguing two issues here, okay? One is financial markets can lead to bubbles, as I expressed earlier. They can get crazy and outsized, and we should do something to regulate them. Number two, even if you believe it couldn't lead to bubbles because markets are efficient, you'd at least have to demand that there would be information about derivatives to make that market efficient. And the mainstream economists didn't even argue that. Now, that's a major indictment. They didn't even bring that up. Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, I think even the left-wingers like Krugman and Stiglitz didn't, to my knowledge, ever bring that disturbing fact up. So that's one of my other bad ideas. I did want to say a quick word about globalization, but globalization is the invisible hand writ large across the world. I did want to say one thing about government's place in the world, because economists, by and large, and I know I'm being sarcastic, there's no real place for government in the economic theory about states, about nations. The only place there is for government is to come in and make markets work correctly again. That's the only place in the theory. Now, all economists agree with that. Friedman even agrees with that. Krugman agrees with that. They'll have bigger definitions, the left wing, bigger definitions of where markets are failing. You've heard the term market failure. But they're by and large willing to argue that government has to get markets back on track. Well, I'd argue that this is bubkis, really, a New York word. Markets usually don't work, I would argue. And in the most important cases, say R&D development, you can't find a nation in the world where R&D development was dependent only on the private sector. In fact, you probably can't, if the work is done carefully, you probably can't find a nation in the world where it's mostly dependent on the private sector. The evidence suggests it's mostly dependent on government investment or government investment in universities, which is close to some of your hearts here. There's a good book on this by a woman named Mariana Mazzucato. That's an Italian name. But I did a review of her book for the New York Review of Books. So that's about 5 of my 7 bad ideas. Now, let me just say a couple of things about what we worry about most. We worry most about inequality. Well, how did this occur? Inequality occurred because economists believe there should be no inequality because markets work too well to allow inequality. And I am not exaggerating. So if there is inequality, the real reason there was inequality was the boom in high technology. The boom in high technology meant to get a decent job, you had to have a better education. The problem was getting better educations didn't increase rapidly enough. That was the argument for a while. Didn't seem to hold up, though. You may have missed this page. Didn't really hold up. The next argument was they conceded globalization might be leading to inequality, competition from low-wage nations. Eventually, clearly that has something to do with what's going on. But economists don't want to admit that because then they'd have to say they're against free trade. Now, why do economists love free trade so much? And there is an argument for free trade. Because the markets work. Because if there are no tariffs and no controls and no quotas, everybody will be better off. Well, that too is by and large bupkis, because we need to be able to control markets in order to encourage investment. Can a small country with a developing small car industry really open its market to free trade? Shouldn't it have the opportunity to hold off? Probably not picking a good example. There are probably high-tech examples that are better that I'm not aware of. But shouldn't they be able to hold off competition for a while? And guess what? Isn't that how America developed? We had tariffs proposed by Alexander Hamilton. We had tariffs to enable our manufacturers to develop. One of the big things about productivity growth is economies of scale, that you can make product in large mass. That, in my view, is what made America great. We had so many of these industries. So I'm going to leave you with this thought. We need government. We need bigger government. That doesn't mean you're a democratic socialist. Maybe it does. But if it does mean you're a democratic socialist, then you better become one. Because we need social policies to control our inequality, to support our wages, minimum wages, very important new idea that suddenly popped up that was widely disputed by economists. Why? Because they disrupt the workings of the market. People are paid what they're worth. Then we get some highly respected economists like Thomas Piketty, who says, that's nonsense. Respected economist who taught at MIT, and you know who he is, on inequality, and not particularly socialist, said just that. That's nonsense. People don't get paid what they're worth. That's a purist version of the invisible hand and efficient markets. So we've been laboring for 30 years under a purist version of how markets work, and it's led to deregulation in finance, it's led to lack of regulation in labor markets, lack of social policies, lack of thinking clearly about why people are poor. My pet project is poor children in America. We have the highest poverty rate in the world, 25% of children under six. Going to repeat it, 25% of children under six are poor by a low standard, lowest rate in the rich world. 15% of the population is poor. High. But 25% of kids under six are high. How can we look at ourselves in the mirror having allowed that to occur? How does that level of neglect occur? Part of it is because of the way these economists think. We need infrastructure. Infrastructure is a great investment at the moment because it's been neglected so long. So, in short, there's a very good case for needing more government, because markets don't work that well. We need serious regulation, and we need public investment, because private sectors won't do the job on their own. Thank you for letting me chew your ear off.
You've just listened to Jeff Madrick, author of Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World, published in 2014. He spoke on October 23, 2015, at the Madison Central Library in Madison, Wisconsin. His talk was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival. To hear this again and to listen to other thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsors.